You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network, Black Culture Amplified.
Hi, and welcome to The Blackest Questions. I'm your host, Dr. Christina Greer, politics editor for The Griot and associate professor of political science at Fordham University. In this podcast, we ask our guests five of the blackest questions so we can learn a little bit more about them and have some fun while we're doing it. We're also going to learn a lot about black history, past and present. So here's the way this works. We have five rounds of questions about us, black history, the whole diaspora, current events, everything. With each round, the questions will get a little bit tougher, and the guest has 15 seconds to get it right. If they answer the question correctly, they will receive one symbolic black fist and hear this. If they get it wrong, they'll hear this, but we'll still love them anyway. And after the five questions, there'll be a black bonus round at the end just for fun. Our guest for this episode is DC native Michael Twitty. He's a culinary historian, independent scholar, food writer, and professor. He's a historical interpreter personally charged with preparing, preserving, and promoting African-American foodways and its parent traditions in the African diaspora and its legacy in the food culture of the American South. He's an award-winning author of The Cooking Gene and can be seen on Netflix's High on the Hog. And he teaches a masterclass on tracing your roots through food. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here at The Blackest Questions.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I really just hope that at some point we can be in the same city and I can just accidentally have you like stumble into my kitchen and maybe make some things. What's your favorite soul food to make?
Oh, Lord. Okay, so I'm just going to call it like it is, fried chicken.
Fried chicken? You know, I can't say that I'm really skilled at fried chicken. My mother and my grandmother both. But, you know, I have my grandmother's sweet potato pie recipe. And so I will say that if I had to sort of go toe-to-toe with someone to sort of show my black card, I'm going to pull out my sweet potato pie recipe.
Heard that.
And how'd you get started in the culinary world?
Just like you said, mother and grandmother. And also my father, bless his memory, was a great cook. And a lot of the men were great cooks in my family as well. So everybody cooked. It was expectation. My grandmother also had an expectation that all of her boys would cook and not go into marriage unskilled. And my mother and I certainly had like a special relationship based on the kitchen. So that did it. But you know what? It's deeper than that because my mom would have me copy down definitions of different like culinary terms. And I was tested on those terms and asked, you know, what's a quarter dice? How much is a teaspoon? All those kind of things. And I would watch culinary shows on the weekends. Because back then, we didn't have no
right.
Food Network or
right.
Cooking Channel. It was always PBS Saturday afternoon. So I would watch Floyd on Fish and Natalie Dupree's New Southern Cooking and Martin Yan's show, Yan Can Cook. And I would just absorb everything I possibly could.
Wow. I am so excited to talk to you today. Are you ready to play the Blackest Questions?
Come on, bring it on.
Oh, good. I love it. I love that confidence. Okay, Michael Twitty coming in with the heat. First question. He was born on August 22nd, 1936 in Gaston, North Carolina, but he later became known as the godfather of go-go music. Who was he?
Chuck Brown.
Ooh, hot. Charles Lewis Brown, a.k.a. Chuck Brown, the D.C. legend, was an entertainer, guitarist, and songwriter. He capitalized on funk's percussive pulse to help shape the sound of go-go music. His family moved to D.C. when he was only 8 years old. And his signature hit, Bustin' Loose, spent 4 weeks atop the R&B singles chart in 1979. I feel like bustin' loose. And is now played every time the Washington Nationals hit a home run inside Nationals Park, which is an amazing way to think about go-go music going sort of mainstream. When speaking of the go-go genre, he said, quote, "It's about love, the communication between performer and the audience. There's no other music like it." He sadly died on May 16th, 2012, and Chuck Brown Memorial Park was built in 2014 to honor his legacy and memory. Did you ever happen to see Chuck Brown in concert growing up in D.C.?
Not growing up, but that was a part of everything from my youth onward. I mean, that was the big thing. If you could say that you were in a go-go band, if you were a teenager, yup, you were the height.
Right, that's peak. Now, I didn't learn to appreciate go-go music until I had a roommate in college from D.C. because I was more into, you know, Baltimore club music. But when you cook, and you have two very successful cookbooks, when you write, do you write to music or do you cook to music?
Yes, I do two things. One of my friends told me, who was an editor, he said to me, I want you to not go too deep or go too soft. I want you to talk to me as if we're at the same kitchen table. Mm. And we're having a conversation that has no boundaries in terms of time. And so that's one element. It's like you and me sitting down at a kitchen table, preparing the food, doing our mise en place, while, you know, Chaka Khan's in the background. Mm. You know, it could be Celia Cruz. Celia Cruz is what I play when I need to hurry up.
Oh, ha! That's right.
She gets, you know, it going. It's like, yeah, she gets it going. And if I'm just like, you know, camping out, next thing I know it's Irene Cara. You know, I have very specific things. If I'm making jollof rice, you know fella is going to come on.
Has to. Must.
Water get no enemy.
Right.
Naja na come last. See, now that I know my DNA stuff, I'm just like, I know where I get my different parts of my identity from. It's kind of cool.
Okay. Well, listen, let's strike while the iron's hot. You ready for question number two?
Yep.
What was the name of the person who was an enslaved chief cook for George Washington and later ran away to freedom?
Hercules Posey.
Mm. Born in 1754, and he was a member of the Mount Vernon slave community, widely admired for his culinary skills. Hercules arrived at Mount Vernon as a teenager in 1767 when President George Washington purchased him from a neighbor. He later married Alice and had three kids, Richard, Evie, and Delia, and he sold kitchen leftovers and kept his earnings. And on February 22, 1797, for Washington's 65th birthday, Hercules ran away and ended up in New York as a cook. And he sadly died of tuberculosis on May 15th, 1812. And so you knew that one quick, fast. And so you mentioned that you learned about your ancestry. When you learned that our ancestors were serving the first president and later escaped to their, you know, to their own freedom, what emotions does that bring you as you sort of write these cookbooks and you cook in the kitchen?
It's incredibly powerful because, you know, these women and men did not play. Mm-hmm. They were strivers. They were entrepreneurs. The two details about Hercules' life I love the most. One is that he had this gold tip cane and he was so well dressed that he took great pride. He was like, you are not going to look at me and call me a slave. You're going to look at me and call me a man. And he expected that of his whole family. And then when he runs off, when he absconds, it's because Washington demoted him and had him out there in the wintertime in Virginia, mucking and throwing mud and doing all this and digging, you know, tunnels. And he's like, no, you don't. And so it made Martha so mad. I love that part. It made Martha so mad that she had to get in that kitchen and figure things out. And the greatest part about this story where I don't know if it's Lafayette or another Frenchman, asks his granddaughter, aren't you sad that granddad's gone? And she's like, nah. My grandfather's free, so that's all you need to know.
Right. Well, so it's, you know, in doing research for your books, you know, there's such a long legacy of Black chefs who have been in all different types of echelons, whether they're working just for their families, you know, cooking, and they work just in the home, or they're serving some of the most powerful men and women in the world. Where do you see yourself kind of trying to live up to their legacy? Or is it a different relationship you have with them and you just see yourself as a part of the lineage and part of the chain that connects us as African-Americans in the culinary world?
These are our ancestors. And so I think about Miss Lucy's Bake Shop. I think about, was her name Sylvia? It was a woman, an elder in Alexandria, Virginia, who sold tomatoes to buy her husband's freedom. I mean, I think about these people all the time. And you know, famously, Maya Angelou once said, because we have forgotten our ancestors, our children forget us. So for me, the act of cooking, and I cook at, you know, Colonial Williamsburg, other sites on occasion. I cook in the close of the 18th and 19th century. I do the work. I show people with colleagues how it was done and the skill that it took. And, you know, I don't let people fantasize about the good old days. I always let them know how it actually was and why we take so many things for granted, but that we need to put respect back on their names as not only our ancestors, but the ancestors of American food, period.
Right. Because, I mean, as I keep ringing this alarm, it's like Black history is American history.
That's right.
And we don't know enough of it. And this is why I started this podcast. But white Americans should feel angered and ashamed that they don't know their own history. Because if you don't know Black history, right, you don't know your own American history. All right, you're coming in hot. I love this. You want to try for number three?
Come on.
Keep it going?
Yep.
So on October 2nd, 1977, as Dusty Baker hit his 30th home run for the Los Angeles Dodgers, this person was there to welcome him at home plate, and by doing so, co-created this particular gesture. Who was the person, and what was the gesture?
It was a high five.
That's right. Do you know who did it with Dusty Baker?
Was it Hank Aaron?
No, it was Glenn Burke.
So Glenn Burke.
Close. But he was born in Oakland, California, and Glenn Burke played for the Dodgers from 76 to 78, and then the Oakland A's from 78 to 79.
I don't know why I went with Say Hey.
Well, you know, listen, you can't win them all, but you're still doing a great job. But Glenn Burke was the first Major League Baseball player to come out as gay to teammates and owners during his career. And he once told the New York Times, "Prejudice drove me out of baseball sooner than I should have, but I wasn't changing." And so sadly, he died of AIDS complications on May 30th in 1995, but was part of the first class of inductees into the National Gay and Lesbian Sports Hall of Fame. And so, wow. You know, are you a baseball fan?
No, but I was going to make a joke 2 seconds ago about, oh, Lord, I'm gay. And she asked me questions about sports. But I guess Ancestor Burke is like, nah. No excuses.
So did you did not watch baseball growing up? Were you more of a kid who was like, listen, I'm in the kitchen. I don't have time to be playing stickball or watching baseball with these fools. Or were you sort of a little bit of both?
Kind of hanging on. Baseball was not as big for us, you know, in our culture. At that time, basketball was bigger. I had no interest in basketball or football. But baseball was more like, because in D.C. and Maryland, you know, we had the Orioles. So everybody was about that Cal Ripken life. And, you know, even if you did nothing, you didn't understand a thing about the game, you went with your friends to games. You know, a lot of parties were held at games, or you just kind of chill. I mean, this was a big part of who you were, whether you liked it or not. My favorite sport is horse racing.
Oh, interesting. Which Baltimore, you know, close to D.C., has a long legacy in Pimlico.
Correct.
Now, when you mentioned Cal Ripken, I was like, listen, I will say, those blue eyes can sometimes, they can be a little dreamy. I'm going to say it. Okay, Cal Ripken, well, if you're listening.
Like, he wasn't rocking, for me, he wasn't rocking Zaddy status at that point.
So,
but you know,
the great thing about this podcast, and this is why we love having such interesting guests on, is because we can talk about sports, we can talk about pioneers being inducted into the National Gay and Lesbian Sports Hall of Fame, we can talk about all the ways that Black people have contributed to making this country much more inclusive and holistic. Okay, so let's keep this train going. You ready for question number four?
Come on.
Who was the first African American cookbook author?
Okay, so this is a trick question. So it's actually Melinda Russell.
Yes, you are correct.
And that Abby Fisher. Abby Fisher was known to be the first one for quite some time, but it's actually Melinda Russell. Yeah.
So in 1866, Melinda Russell self-published A Domestic Cookbook containing a careful selection of useful receipts for the kitchen. The book concentrates on baking recipes, savory dishes, and also methods for preparing household items like cologne and shampoo. And it was also the first book to offer culinary advice by an African-American woman. She published it as a free woman living in Paw Paw, Michigan, as a fundraising effort to return to Tennessee, which, you know, caught my attention because my great-grandparents are from Tennessee. And when did you first learn about Melinda Russell?
from Dr. Lenny Sorensen.
Okay.
Who I've kind of as a friend, as a mentor. Dr. Lenny Sorensen was for many years the African-American research historian at Monticello, and made it her passion to dig up these narratives about the Monticello community and beyond. So we were talking about this when they actually kind of nailed down Melinda's narrative and cookbook. But, you know, Abby Fisher was cool too. But, you know, it's interesting that you look at these cookbooks, these receipt books, and you don't really see what you, it's like the shadow of what you recognize in today's Southern kitchen. It's not really the whole thing. So, for example, I was on a program with a digital program with Hannah Hart, and we made Abby Fisher's jambalaya. Could you call it jumberly? That's more like red rice than it is actual jambalaya. So people were just like, "There ain't no jambalaya. I'm Louisiana." I'm like, "Y'all got to calm down. These things evolve and they change mm-hmm. over time."
Mm-hmm. Now, what inspired you to write a cookbook? Because there are a lot of chefs who just like being in the kitchen, and that is where. That's where their intellectual and emotional space thrives. It seems as though, because you've got a new cookbook coming out, which I want you to tell us a little bit more about, but it seems as though you are trying to balance these two very big passions. One, which is being in the kitchen and creating this environment for us to, mm-hmm. to nourish us physically. But then you're also creating this ancestral legacy through education. And, you know, as a professor, I love the fact that you're writing some of these stories down. You're writing down some of these emotions. What made you shift out of the kitchen and realize the necessity to write certain things down?
We don't have enough Black food memoir. So we have little snippets. There are snippets in Zora Neale Hurston's work. There are snippets in Black Boy by Richard Wright. There are snippets in all of these classic works. we need, let's say, talk about Verdamé Grosvenor, you know, or in Tozaki Shange. You know, both of them wrote short but important culinary narratives. They weren't necessarily cookbooks. So for me, The Cooking Gene, the purpose of that book was to take the reader through my family history, through food, from Africa to America, from slavery to freedom, because I wanted to be able to do what ancestor Alex Haley did. And when I actually began to write the book and knew I had things in the works, I went all the way to Henning, Tennessee, to the front yard of his grandmother's house where he's buried. And I poured libation, had a little talk with ancestor Alex about this. And it's like, we have to be willing and able as Black people to extend that vulnerability, extend that honesty, and, you know, to the reader. And let them know, this is what it's like. It's not just about the food or the techniques. What is it, what, I remember, you know that look that our elders had and we inherited, that the children will have, of walking in the house Black mm-hmm. after a long day? Mm-hmm. And I remember that everybody in my family walking into the kitchen and, you know, the lynching stories poured out, the venting poured out, or the jokes poured out. You know, the hugs, the kisses, the emotion. And I grew up in a very diverse area. I never saw people walk in the kitchen like us. And so for me, I wanted to let people know that all that other stuff that they think is superfluous is very much a part of the food, the generosity, the hospitality, the community in gathering.
You know, it's when you said that piece about walking into a kitchen. You know, I think about my grandmother who was in Yulee, Florida, which is a tiny, tiny town in northern Florida, north of Jacksonville. And there was something about that kitchen where, you know, she told me when I was a kid, you know, she had, our grandmother wore those house dresses, you know, just those cotton yes. house dresses that yes. had little pockets. And so she said whenever I came to visit, she could always feel my little hand creep into her pocket because she kept cookies in there. So I was can you imagine just sitting at the sink washing dishes and she'd look out and my grandfather had all this land where he raised hogs.
Wow.
And so she said she'd feel this little hand creep into her pocket. She knew it was me waiting for a little afternoon cookie. And then later on, many years later, when I went to college, And of course, you know, you go to college, it's like, I don't eat beef, I don't eat pork, you know, that's fine. You know, everybody goes through those phases. I know our listeners, I'm sure some of you have gone through those various phases. And my grandfather looked at me and said, what do you mean you don't eat pork? And he was like, the hog put your mother through college, because he worked at a paper mill, but he raised hogs on the side for extra money, and that's what helped pay for my mother to go to college. And he took it as an insult that I wouldn't eat a particular food that he had A, raised, and B, it had served as such an important food in our family and in our family history. And he looked me in the eyes and he said, never trust a man with no facial hair and never trust a man who doesn't eat meat. Now, granted, for our listeners out there, this is my grandfather who was born in 1920, so he's allowed to have certain views. But I think the facial hair was, you know, basically someone who's in law enforcement. And so, you know, you want somebody with facial hair, which means that they're not. And then the meat part, and I said, well, why can't I date someone who doesn't eat meat? And he said, a man who doesn't eat meat isn't concerned with putting meat on your table. And I was like, oh, okay. Whoop. So it's been fascinating to think about how my grandfather viewed food as a way to show his sort of authority as a provider for the family. And the hog was literally a symbol of sort of the hard work that he felt he was expressing toward my grandmother and his three daughters, which, you know, and it's so funny because my white friends, their grandfathers always said, never trust a man with facial hair. My grandmother said, never trust a man without facial hair. So it's how these things work out.
My grandfather used to tell us that when he was coming up, his parents would say to him, don't drink no coffee, you're going to turn white. Mm. And so the first time he ever worked in an integrated space in South Carolina, this white man told him, he said, I don't drink no coffee neither. I said, he said, how come? He said, because my parents told me, don't drink no coffee, you're going to turn colored. And they laughed because they had been told, basically, these are both Depression era people who were told to leave alone one of the most expensive things in the household. So they laughed. They became very good friends. But, you know, it was also that kind of like joint space of honesty. Like, yes. Okay.
Well, I mean, and before we get to the next question, but, you know, in the kitchen in many ways is a vulnerable space, you know? So like, what are some of the conversations that you've been able to have? I mean, you are a black man who identifies as gay. You have grown up in DC, but you're from this, it seems like a very strong tradition of people who believe in cooking. So it's not like you're rebelling against the family to do this necessarily. But what are some of the conversations that you've had with people, either black folks or non-black folks in the kitchen that have changed your life?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is, you know, we tend to talk about our people, right, who our kinfolk are, and how different people relate to that. One of the best times I ever had on Twitter, which can be a hellscape sometimes,
but it can be so great too,
is when I was preparing for the masterclass, and I asked people from Black American, Afro-Latin, Caribbean, Haitian, Brazilian culture, I said, what's in your kitchen? What do you have to have in your kitchen? And what made my heart swell, it made me so happy, it made me smile, was that 80% of the artifacts people have in their kitchen was exactly the same no matter what part of the black world they came from. Mm-hmm. So the spider plant was in there, and those big-ass spoons that they used to whip you with was in there. And, you know, the embroidered or black-lighted or whatever thing of what state or country you came from. So it could have been the Virgin Islands, could have been St. Kitts, could have been Antigua, could have been Alabama, Georgia, wherever. You know, things like that. The hot comb.
Listen.
You know, all of those elements. Oh, and don't forget the grease jar. The three grease jars.
Listen, Michael Twitty, I was about to say grease jar. It's like, no, you got your fish grease, you got your chicken grease, and you got your bacon grease.
That's right. That's right. And then chock full of nuts.
Yeah. Okay, listen, I'm a little fancy because I keep my bacon grease in the refrigerator, so it's not sitting on my stove. But let me tell you the scandal that is Christina Greer. Because, as I mentioned before, my grandparents, my mother's grandparents, you know, lived in Yulee, Florida when I was growing up. My father's mother unfortunately passed before I was born, and his father passed when I was in high school, and he was in Miami. So it was a very, kind of felt northern when I was visiting my dad's dad. But when I visited my mom's parents, you know, it's a swamp. You know, there's that sandy soil. There are those moss trees everywhere. So, you know, my grandmother's growing massive pieces of okra in the backyard, you know, 14 inches long. Where I'm like, oh, I'll go cut it. And she's like, watch out for the snakes. I'm like, never mind. You know, like, I don't do snakes. But the biggest scandal was one time Chrissy Greer thinks that she's helping cleaning the kitchen. I'm young. And I just pour the grease into the wrong grease can. And my grandparents looked at me like, what is wrong with this northern child? Like, Gloria, this is my mother's name. It's like, essentially, you ain't raising this girl right. Like, how does she not know that you don't just put the grease anywhere? Like, she doesn't know the difference between bacon grease and chicken grease. Like, she can't look. So I'm going to say I have come a long, long way. I've come a long, long way. But I still got a long way to go. Okay, so are you ready for this last question? You were doing amazing.
Absolutely.
Okay, last question. Of the numerous awards this chef received, who was the only Black person to be featured in the Celebrity Chef postage stamp series in 2014?
Edna Lewis.
Oh my goodness, you're hot today. So Edna Lewis, you are correct. The stamp was released September 26, 2014, and 4 million were issued. Edna Lewis was born April 13th, 1916 in Freetown, Virginia. And while living in New York, she began throwing dinner parties and later worked in a cafe serving Southern-inspired dishes. She opened her own restaurants, and a few odd jobs later, she wrote the Edna Lewis Cookbook in 1972. Then in 1976, she wrote The Taste of Country Cooking. She wrote two more books and won the first James Beard Living Legend Award, and she sadly died February 13th, 2006 in Decatur, Georgia. So did you ever cross paths with Edna Lewis?
I never knew Miss Edna personally.
Okay.
I did have the opportunity to often rub elbows with Leah Chase and Mama Dip. Mm-hmm. And of course, I know the living legend, Miss Sally Ann Robinson. And it's, you know, it's important because we have a whole generation of people who are that kind of like the bringers, the bearers of the tradition. And it's so critical that we ask them everything we can and learn from them. And also remember what Edna Lewis said. The most famous thing she said was to one of my other teachers and friends and mentors, Toni Tipton Martin. She said, leave no stone unturned. It ain't just about, in other words, it ain't just about me or what I did or what I know. There's lots of us out here that need to be, you know, interrogated as to what we know so we can pass it on.
Absolutely. Now, when you think about sort of passing that on, what kind of influence are you trying to make with younger chefs who are getting started?
First of all, I want them to reclaim their identity. We've been working on, we're going to finally go back to the continent next year. We've been doing a group tour with Roots to Glory Tours, that's culinary based. And so we're going to Cameroon, we've been to Ghana, we've been to Benin and Togo, we've been to Senegal and Gambia. Now we're gonna go to Cameroon, which I've been to before. And the whole goal is to get Black diaspora chefs who had never been to the continent or wanna go back to the continent to have a full-on gastronomic culinary experience where we learn from and teach. So while we're learning about the foodways of different ethnic groups in the continent, we're also out there teaching them about African-American, Afro-Caribbean, Afro-Brazilian, Haitian food. So it's a true exchange between the members of the family. And, you know, to see some of these chefs walk out of there, and it's not just chefs, but Somalis, nutritionists, educators, people from all different walks of life with food and drink, to walk out of there with a sense of pride and identity. And of course, we always have like a naming ceremony, and some people actually do trace their roots back to whatever country we're in. So we always make sure we, you know, we meet up with the people and have that kind of thing. So it's thrilling. It's very exciting because I just want people to understand our food has roots and our food has wings.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, as you were saying this, I was like, okay, how do I hustle myself on this trip? I was like, I got one sweet potato pie recipe. How do I make it to Cameroon? And obviously I was like, well, I'm a birder. Maybe I should go and just like, you know, interview some folks while I'm birding and see. But when you say our food has wings, I mean, I always think about, you know, something like rice or something like okra, right? You know, I'm a rice connoisseur. Everyone who knows me knows if you're Dominican, if you're Haitian, if you are Nigerian, if you're Ghanaian, I'm going to come to your house. I'm going to eat you out of house and home. I don't care if you're cooking, your mama's cooking, your grandma's cooking. I'm going to forget that my name is Dr. Christina Greer. I'm going to sit at that table and I'm going to eat about 7 bowls of rice and I'm not getting up until I'm done. And so I have no shame when it comes to being a rice connoisseur, and I love all the different types of rice. But I also think about okra and how we can find it in so many different cultures, you know, no matter where we travel.
And it's the, you know, I'll tell you one little story. So in Africa, you can easily buy too much of something because you don't think about the numbers in the exchange. So I ended up with a bag full of okra, which I forgot about, and ended up in my luggage in America. And as Miss Ann is walking past with her dog, the okra starts falling out. Apparently, they didn't notice. Anxious was like, nope, don't look over here. And I, you know, I planted that okra. Beautiful, beautiful okra from Benin. Yeah, that's right. Oh, birding. You will want for nothing in Africa, I'm telling you. In the Gambia, we were at this space by the between the Gambia River and the ocean. And one of the most beautiful things in the world is to see the flamingos and the gulls and the terns and the cormorants and all the different kind of birds. And all the little beautiful, colorful birds show up, but they are so loud. They will wake you up.
Absolutely. I mean, I spent some time on the east and the west, and these birds are like, let me let you know who's running things.
One gunshot, and they all start flying away.
Right. Michael Twitty, it has been such a pleasure to talk to you about food and writing and our ancestry. Before I let you out of here, you have some time for the Black bonus round?
Sure.
Okay, these are fast and furious. You ready?
All right.
Okay. Sweet tea or unsweetened tea?
Oh, sweet.
Macaroni and cheese. Is it a side dish or a main dish?
It's got side dish. Sorry.
What city or region has the best food?
New Orleans.
What is your Thanksgiving must have?
My mother's cornbread dressing.
If you could rename the Arnold Palmer, which is the lemonade and iced tea, mm-hmm. who would you rename it after?
The Prince.
The Prince, okay. And in Baltimore, you know, they call it half and half, which I love.
Yes.
I'm always like, I'll take a half and half. What is your go-to seasoning?
I said that before. Go-to food?
Go-to seasoning.
Go-to seasoning. Seasoned salt.
Seasoned salt? Okay, and here's the controversial one. I'm going to share a little secret with you after you answer this. What do you put on your grits?
Okay. So, I'm going to give you, do you want the white answer or the black answer?
I want both.
Butter or sugar.
Okay. Now, Michael, I'm going to share something with you that a few people know. I, as I said before, my grandparents really struggled with this grandbaby from the north. I love grits. I love fried fish and grits. That's what we eat in our family. With a little bit of mustard on the yellow mustard on the fish and some fresh lime and some hot sauce. I can only eat grits one way. And I need you to promise me before I tell you this that we can still be friends and we can work together and hopefully we can go on the continent and go birding and talk about food and maybe we can listen to some go-go music. But I need you to promise me that you are not going to abandon me once I tell you the truth about myself.
Okay, come on.
I can only eat grits with ketchup and mustard until it's fluorescent orange. And I'm telling you the honest to God truth. And I know that my poor grandmother is rolling around in her grave, so ashamed of her baby, so ashamed. All of my awards and accomplishments mean nothing because I can only eat my grits with ketchup and mustard until they fluorescent orange, and then I put a piece of hot fried fish on top with my hot sauce, my lemon juice, or my lime juice, and my yellow mustard. And on that note,
I will forgive you.
Okay.
In the background of my head, I'm literally hearing Miss Tony say, "How you want Carrie?"
What's up?
West Side.
Okay. Promise me that we're going to cook together one day.
We ain't going to make that, but we'll cook together.
We won't make grits? You won't allow it?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
That's my kryptonite right there, that certain condiment. It's like, mm-mm. Okay.
What is mustard or ketchup?
The other one, the red one.
Oh, the red one. Okay, interesting.
Do not have it even in the house. Mm-mm.
So when you come back next time, we'll have to do a deep dive into why it is that we don't have the K word in the house.
It's the devil.
Okay. Well, listen, you did an amazing job on Blackest Questions. I can't thank you enough for joining us. And I want to thank our listeners for listening to the Blackest Questions. The show is produced by Richard White, Cameron Blackwell, and Camille Cruz. If you like what you heard, please download the Griot app and listen and watch many more great shows and share it with everyone you know.
Don't forget, you can listen to the Griot's Writing Black podcast hosted by me, Maisha Kai. This isn't your typical writing podcast. We interview any and everybody that has anything to do with writing, from comics to poets to authors to journalists to politicians and more. Remember, that's Writing Black every Sunday right here on the Griot's Black Podcast Network. Download the Griot's app to listen to Writing Black wherever you are.